That's your problem. You're too good at monetizing things.
$4,000 to $7,000 a month. This year, so far, at least 10 grand from speaking.
Your favorite ways to make money in this business?
My favorite way to make money is to write stuff.
You did write in a recent issue that you've made over $150,000 from your 3 newsletters.
And I have such a small audience. Like, if I can do it, you can do it, right?
Exactly. Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Today, we are speaking with Lex Roman. Lex is very much a multi-hyphenate, having done everything from TV production to UX design to growth marketing, but I found them through their excellent newsletter, Journalists Pay Themselves. So Lex, you do a lot. I think by my count, you're currently producing 2 newsletters, which are Journalists Pay Themselves and Revenue Rule Breaker, and you're working as a freelance growth marketer. And you're helping organize this Atlanta Solopreneurs Co-op. And I'm probably missing a couple other things. Is that everything you're doing?
Yeah, no, I do a lot. I do too much. It's way too much. Yeah. Creators can relate though, don't you think?
Because yes.
It's like you have ideas and then you act on them. And when you can monetize them as I can, they take off a bit farther.
That's
than
your problem.
Expect.
You're too good at monetizing things. Okay, so I don't want to like rehash like your entire career, but I am interested in the transition moment. So you graduate college, you spend 5 years in TV and film production, 6 years in UX and product design, and now it's been like 5 years in growth marketing. And then within those growth marketing years, you've also become a creator and started helping other creators and kind of angling yourself, labeling yourself as a creator. So again, don't have to rehash the whole thing, but I'm really interested in like the transitions, why you go from being a TV film producer to UX product design, et cetera, up to where we are now.
Yeah. So I was in TV in 2007. And in 2008, the first writer's strike happened of this era. And I had to look for another job. And then coming right back into the industry, I happened to meet someone in tech named Arturo Perez, who I would later go on to work for. And this was right when Netflix was starting to get into streaming. Mm-hmm. So in 2007, they're still shipping DVDs and they're starting to get into streaming. And Arturo says to me, Lex, streaming is going to kill your industry. You should get into tech. So he said that to me in like 2007, 2008. I finally take him up on that in 2012. I'm hitting some internal industry union problems in TV. As you might know, like there's different crafts, different unions for different
guilds.
Crafts. Yeah. And I couldn't switch into the union that I wanted to be in. And so Arturo was like, come be a UX designer. And so I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. And I went and did that for technically like 10 years. I changed that title a bunch.
Yeah.
And I started going by growth designer.
Okay.
Which is sort of adjacent to growth marketing.
And something that you kind of helped trailblaze as a category.
Yes. Yeah. I helped label it and popularize it for sure. And spent actually many years in tech convincing people that it wasn't marketing and then went and changed and became a marketer myself. So I quit tech in 2021. Mm-hmm. I started working for myself in 2019. The most obvious thing to do was to work for tech companies. So I worked for Gusto for 6 months on a growth design project. The pandemic hit in 2020 and I was like, what should I be doing? And then I was like, I really don't want to do tech anymore. I just feel like it's run its course for me.
After like a decade of it.
After a decade. And so I started looking at small businesses and I switched into small business and sort of stumbled my way through that, found creative entrepreneurs, started working with them. And that sort of led me to the creator space.
Yeah. Okay. Creative entrepreneur, is that different than a creator in your mind?
Yes. To me, a creative entrepreneur is like a web designer, a copywriter, an audio producer. Generally, a service provider, though not exclusively.
Yes, I agree with that. I do want to hear how you define the term creator. This is something that people always have like a slightly different answer on.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, actually. And for a while I was like, can I call myself a creator? Mm-hmm. I think to me, it has to do with whether or not content creation is a main way that you make money.
Mm-hmm.
So there are hybrids, right? There's people that are web designers who are also content creators.
Yeah.
And I think if it's a substantial revenue stream for you, you can call yourself a creator. I mean, I'm not a gatekeeper though. Like everyone should be able to call themselves a creator if they want to. But in my mind, that switch happened when I started making money from content.
It's when content is the tip of the spear.
For me, that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I like that. The way I've been, like, the definition I've been stuck on for a little while is basically just like somebody who is creating content for the internet for an audience beyond, you know, anybody they know in real life. But I think the way you kind of define it there is telling, and I think is also like really more useful, is like they're making money from it. It's like the main way they're making money. When I asked Ryan Broderick this back in like February or March, whenever I interviewed him, he had like a good answer, but at first he quipped, well, the whole answer was good, but at first he quipped, a creator is a gig worker for content, an Uber driver for posts. And then more seriously, he said, it's people making internet content as the main thing. It's not like they're making something online to be read elsewhere, which is what you said. But I'm curious what you think about that Uber driver for posts, kind of like tongue in cheek.
It's funny. I mean, it's funny to hear that he qualified it that way, because to me, that speaks to like the brand deal.
Yeah.
You know, arrangement that a lot of creators have, which I don't think is his main monetization, is it?
No, he makes the bulk of his income through subscription revenue.
Right.
Yeah.
So in that way, I think that like, that's why I'm so interested in readers funding your work or your audience funding your work, because it's like, you feel less that way. I think you definitely feel like an Uber driver for posts when you exclusively do brand deals or when that's the bulk of your revenue.
Yeah. Well, okay. This is, I agree. And I think that's a good point. But then I think when there's like a platform that's like revenue share, like let's say YouTube, right? They take 45% of AdSense revenue, or Substack, you know, their business model is taking 10% of subscription revenue. To me, like when it's that kind of revenue share thing, like that is like you own the car maybe, but like you don't own the means of like getting customers and like the cash register, et cetera. So I think there's like some comparison there too, right?
Okay. I think in YouTube, that is extremely true, because it's hard to drive people into YouTube. As a YouTuber, you start to rely on them quite a bit. I think it's starting to become more true on Substack, but I actually would argue that it's not that true on Substack.
Yeah.
The people that are successful on Substack know how to drive an audience there and could do that on any platform. And this is the big thing with Substack. People see that these Substackers are popular and they think Substack's doing it, but that's generally not the case.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think too, I read one of your posts earlier today, like you were saying that Substack is like a great place to start and then people leave, which I'm not trying to make this like a beehive pitch thing, but I do want to know. So I think this Sunday, your platform issue comes out. This podcast will already be out by then. This will come out a week from today. So I would love, you've been hyping this up a bit. I would love to hear what you're writing about in this platform issue. Listener, you should go read it. It's out now as you listen to this.
Yeah, no kidding. So the platforms that I'm covering will be Substack, Beehive, and Ghost. Those are the three that, because I'm focused on journalists, those are the three that I hear about the most. Though there are some journalists that are on like various instances of WordPress through like news software platforms like Lead and IndieGraph. Substack, in my circles, Substack has been like the big player for newsletter creators for a long time. Like at least since 2020, which is when I first started my Substack. And that's when Lenny started as well, right? And I wrote one of Lenny's early issues. So I remember that time on Substack when you could still hook up your Twitter account and they had like a functional API and they would just get all your followers onto. Yeah, it really feels that way. But Substack still, like, I see people on LinkedIn all the time being like, oh, I'm going to start a newsletter. Obviously, it's going to be a Substack, right? And I think, you know, maybe not to overcredit Beehive, but I do think Beehive has changed the game on that, where it's like, well, maybe it's not Substack actually, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, I'm a huge Beehive fan, as you probably know, and that's because I think Beehive married all the growth things that worked on Substack with the monetization side that we were missing. And Substack, frankly, is bad at monetization.
Yeah.
Like, they're subsidizing subscriptions now. Have you seen that?
I have, the thing where it's like, they email you, here's a free month if you download the app.
Yes. Something's off there, right? Like, and so my question about Substack is like, do they not know how to sell reader subscriptions, or are they choosing to be bad at that? Which doesn't quite make sense, because to your point, they would fill their own pocket. But it's just like, at this point, we know what works to drive reader subscriptions. They're choosing not to do most of that stuff. It's a little weird. Ghost is interesting because Ghost has sort of become like a publishing platform, almost like a WordPress replacement.
Yeah. It's more for like publications, whereas like a Substack is more for individual columnists, whereas a Beehive can be kind of either.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, to me, Beehive's the best of everything. Not to oversell Beehive. Yeah. Like I am.
We'll move off the platform shortly.
Yeah. I'm genuinely a Beehive fan because I think that like the Beehive team just gets what a newsletter business is. So my line there is like, if you want your business to be coming from your newsletter, if you want to run a newsletter business, Beehive is where you do that. If you want like a better version of social media and you miss like nice social media, quote unquote, that's what Substack's kind of doing.
Yes, it's the social media platform. Okay, so not to bore our listeners too much with inside baseball, though this is kind of an inside baseball podcast. Okay, so in an issue of one of your newsletters, Revenue Rule Breaker, about a month ago, you wrote, "I'm actually not the best at growing audiences, but I am really good," all caps, "at monetizing the hell out of an existing audience." And you go on to say that you had 500 emails on your list when you started growth trackers, which you built your low energy leads newsletter out of, which you then grew to 1500 subscribers over 2 years, and 400 of those people purchased something from you. So that was a lot, but what I want to hear about is these two things: why you say you're not the best at growing audiences but are really good at monetizing an existing audience.
Yeah, first of all, I'm super impressed that you can keep all my brands straight. I have like a portfolio of brands that are a little ridiculous. So yeah, it's funny to hear a growth person, I think, say, like, I've been a professional growth practitioner now for 12 years.
Yeah.
So it's funny to hear a growth person be like, I'm bad at growing audiences. So, you know, to go back a little bit into my career, growth design, my profession in tech, the thing that I popularized was not actually about like going viral or acquiring random strangers on the internet. It was about how many people come to your website who are leaving.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, we have all these people coming in, but they're leaving.
Well, the growth, what you're growing is money, right? It's not necessarily audience. It's revenue. Yes.
It's both. It's both, but it's like, if you have a website where you're getting a bunch of people to come to that website and they're leaving, then that audience doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how many people you can get to a YouTube video if they never, ever, ever come back, right? Mm-hmm. And we see this happen, like people have a viral post and they're like, weird, no one subscribed to my newsletter. And it's like, we weren't connecting the dots there between the content you created and what you normally create. And so, yeah, you had a viral post about some lifestyle thing and that's not what your content's about. So people didn't come over. So the skill set that I developed in tech was really about conversion, right? It's like, okay, how do I turn this person who's like casually showing up into a loyal fan who, you know, knows, likes, and trusts me and wants to buy from me? And so I sort of mastered that in for tech companies. And then I brought that over into my small business arena, right? And I taught a lot of my clients that because they were like, well, all these people are disposable and I should just like spam everyone with Instagram reels and then somebody will buy something. And it's like, no, that's not how it works. So much of business is relationships. And the truth is, even for viral creators, a lot of that virality is coming from their relationships with other creators who are boosting their stuff.
That's like the main, I was just writing about that. I'm working on tomorrow's newsletter right now. I just wrote sentences to that exact point.
Yeah. It's like a secret that no one talks about, but it's like relationships are driving a lot of growth, right? And the whole premise of word of mouth is networks of relationships. So once you understand that, you can start investing in fans and then thinking about, okay, what do these people want? And how do I give that to them in a package way that they're going to buy something? And that's been, my whole business has been about cracking that puzzle and helping other people crack that puzzle. So with Growth Trackers, when I launched Growth Trackers was a membership program. It was very high touch. I make a distinction between subscriptions and membership. And the distinction there is membership tends to be more community, right? You're meeting me, we're interfacing. Subscription tends to be more sort of like over the wall.
Faceless.
So like a media subscription.
Yeah.
You subscribe to NPR, you don't necessarily meet the reporters.
Yeah.
So when I launched Growth Trackers, the first people I went to were my past clients. And I was like, hey, you guys have said that you want to keep working with me on growth projects, that you want to keep experimenting with your marketing together. How about we do this? And then 10 of them were like, yes. And so I booked my founding class that way, right?
Yeah.
And then I just kept going back to my audience and saying, like, do you know someone? Do you want to be a part of this? And that worked. Like, essentially, mm-hmm. that's how I sold that. And then, you know,
which is what small businesses are all about, is like that high touch, that like that, you know, the person behind the counter you shake hands with who knows your name and like knows your order, et cetera. Like, that's what it is all about.
Yes, it is. Actually, a journalist, Seamus Hughes, who writes Court Watch, said this earlier this week. He said, one of my favorite things to do is to write a personal thank you note to every new paying subscriber. Yeah. And I find that that keeps them around longer because they know me and they can come to me if they have questions, and it builds trust. And it's like, it's so overlooked. But when you do that, people want to come back and they want to pay you and they want to promote you. And it that's where the growth engine comes from.
Yeah. Which is like, to me, I think people, I mean, this is, I guess, what we've already been talking about, but people always think that, like, you know, you want a big audience, but like, really, it's not how many people follow you, it's who follows you, that kind of thing. Would you agree that, like, for most people, whether that's creators or indie journalists, whatever, you're kind of more after a boutique approach versus a scale approach?
I think you are now, actually. Mm-hmm. And the writers behind 404, are any of the 404 writers coming to your event?
Yes, Samantha.
Sam, yeah. Right, yeah.
Sam, yeah.
So they've talked about this, right? They're like, they've talked actually extensively about how when they were at Motherboard, it was all about SEO, it was all about views, it was all about ads and things like that. And now it's like, it's about paying subscribers.
Content's not free anymore. I took that from you.
Mm-hmm. So I love that because it means that they're investing in their readers, they're investing in their community. Like, to me, that's like a fully aligned revenue model where we're producing content for our audience directly. They want to pay us. It's just like, there's no like weird third party involved in driving, you know, how things are going down. So yeah, I think when you focus on that, when you focus on the monetization there, when you focus on your loyal fans, you show up better in your business, and you're not just like out meeting strangers. You're focused on the people that matter. And guess what? They help you meet strangers. And
well, this is so one thing I like I've been thinking about recently is like, you know, the internet as the global village, right? Like, this is, and that's not just the internet, but like this concept of the global village. I feel like it's much more productive to think of things in terms of like villages that you can access globally. I don't know. I haven't got the nomenclature down perfectly, but it's like that is more and more what is more useful for the internet. Like having like pockets, right? Like the monoculture isn't good for anyone or anything or anybody's business. I don't know. I'm all about global villages these days.
Interesting. Okay. Global villages. Yeah. I'm going to have to come around to that model. I think like, I definitely think niche communities are having a moment right now. And that like, it's just the internet has changed so much. Like the algorithms are not what they used to be. Mm-hmm. Google is sort of like flooded by SEO teams, right?
And being and cannibalizing that as well, putting, you know, like the AI generated summaries.
Oh my God. Just total nonsense. And then social media platforms, like, you know, some people can crack those. Mm-hmm. And I've definitely like in the journalism space, I've definitely come across journalists that are excellent at social media. And if that is you, awesome. But that's not a lot of us, right? There's a lot of us that are good writers or good creators or whatever. But we're like not so great at Instagram Reels. We can't crack TikTok, or YouTube isn't our bag. And so it's like, that doesn't mean that you don't have a distribution model. It just means that that's not it.
Not the one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think leaning into your relationships, whether it's your fans, your readers, your viewers, or partners, co-promoters, is plenty. Like, I'm proving that you can make a living out of that.
Yeah. Okay, so speaking of making a living, you did write in a recent issue of Journalists Pay Themselves that you've made over $150,000 from your three newsletters in the last few years, and that revenue spans from sponsorships and paid subscriptions to digital products, memberships, coaching sessions, and speaking gigs. Can you say which of those were like the biggest portion of that 150, and like which are the smallest?
Yeah. The biggest portion is my membership. So Growth Trackers was $500 a month.
Yeah.
So it was an expensive membership.
Which, wait, let's say quickly for the listeners, this is something you did for 2 years that was like a membership community with a newsletter for, again, creative entrepreneurs looking to grow their business and get
exactly. Leads. Yeah. And it included a bunch of live sessions. I had created a lot of content that was paywalled, you know, inside that community for them. That community actually is still going, just for free. Like we have an alumni community. But that was the majority of my revenue. So I made $4,000 to $7,000 a month on growth trackers. So it was like my anchor revenue stream, I call it. And then on top of that, speaking gigs actually is something I'm taking more seriously this year. But I think I've made this year so far at least 10 grand from speaking.
Yeah.
I get paid most of my speaking stuff right now is like trainings and workshops. So there's a program called Pollen, which was actually adjacent to Growth Trackers, also for creative entrepreneurs and folks that were leaving corporate.
Is this inbound or outbound mostly?
It's been mostly inbound, which is wild. And That's ideal. With journalists pay themselves, I've been really impressed by the newsletter to speaking gig pipeline. So I've I've had people reading the newsletter and say, hey, I'd really like for you to come talk to our, you know, I'm speaking with the TV critics next week, the TV Critics Association. Shout out to them. We love our TV critics as a former TV production person. And that came from the newsletter. And I spoke with Tiny News Collective in October, similarly. Yeah.
Nice. That's always good. I feel like I was hoping that'd be the answer because I feel like, I don't know, sometimes I'll get outreach for like to be a guest on this podcast or whatever. And, you know, sometimes I consider it and I always look, but I'm always like, I'm always a little suspect of that. So I'm happy for you that, that you're finding success.
I mean, I think it's good. It's good to vet that stuff, right? And I'm prioritizing paid speaking gigs going into next year. Like in the past, I've definitely done a lot of free stuff as well. Yeah.
Well, okay, wait, what are the top three of those, of all those things? I'd imagine this might be a little different from which was the biggest portion of revenue. What are like the top three or like, I don't know, your favorite ways to make money in this business?
My favorite way to make money is to write stuff and have people like contribute to. So in October, I did an appeal to my reader because like, so since I started Journalists Pay Themselves, I've been like, obviously you guys can do this. And a lot of journalists have been like, I don't think I can. And, you know, Catherine Reynolds Lewis, not to call her out if she's listening to this. I love her. I really admire her. But she was like on her podcast, actually, was like, I don't believe that journalists can make $1,000 to $2,000 in revenue a month from their readers. And I've had several journalists say that to me. They're like, I don't think that this is possible. And I was like, OK, let me do this again. And like, let's see. Right. So I made an appeal to my newsletter, Low Energy Leads, which is now only paid in October, beginning of October. And I said, hey, you can buy the paid version of this newsletter for $100. And 54 people did it. So I made
Like a one-off product, right?
Correct.
Because it's just the archive now.
I made $5,000. And then several of those people bought into a subscription version of that. So $99 a year. And now I'm selling the subscription version. So the lifetime deal has expired. That was just for October. And now people are buying the subscription. And my goal is to sell 100 by the end of the year, which will be $10,000 in revenue, which is, you know, roughly 1,000 a month, even though I started in October. So technically it'll be, you know, 3,500 a month. And so for me, if I can get 500 paying readers at $99 a year, that's $50,000.
Yeah.
That's so, my ideal situation. It's starting to become like doable. And I have such a small audience. Like if I can do it, you can do it. Right.
Well, so I think this is like one of the big conflicts in the creator economy is like there are these really creative minded people who maybe aren't as good at, you know, the business side, process, marketing, all that. They've got a good product, quality product, but they can't make it sustainable. And then there are the business minded people who are great at process, marketing, monetization, et cetera. And, you know, they're producing a product that people like and will read and subscribe to, or they can generate ad revenue off of, but it's like maybe not as high quality as like those more creative people. And I think this is like, you know, two poles of a spectrum. These are two extremes. Most people probably fall more in the middle, but I think like it's interesting that you come to this from more of a growth marketing side, right? And like you have this, you know how to do the monetization side, but you're also not like building this like evil empire, flooding the zone type of thing, right? But yeah, I think this is a theme in Journalists Pay Themselves too, is that like, you know, journalists have this distaste for marketing, which I agree. Like I graduated college, thought I was going to be a journalist going in, came out thinking I was going to be a marketer, didn't want to go into marketing because I was like, this sucks. And look where we are today. I'm a bit of both. But okay.
Turns out that line's actually kind of thin.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But so this is what I'm curious about is like how you communicate to journalists, because you work with a lot of journalists now. Like, how do you like make this palatable and like help people understand how to like do marketing in a way that like is palatable?
Yeah. I mean, lucky for me, they've realized it already, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of journalists are starting their own newsrooms or starting their own publications. And they're like, wow, more people should be paying me, especially people who are seeing like a big free audience growth. They're like, okay, well, 10,000 people are here, but 50 of them are paying me. It really should be like 1,000 people paying me or 2,000 people paying me. So how do I make that happen? Lucky for journalists, it's a pretty easy course correction. Like if I had to pick which camp to be in, the growth marketers or the journalists have just a better shot of making money. Marketers and business people who know how to monetize, if their content's not good, it's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard to you know, put lipstick on a pig or whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
But for journalists, it's like the content is good. What I noticed that they're missing is selling why people would subscribe or why people would mm-hmm. contribute. So they're often just missing this piece of like, they're not even really telling people they can contribute, or they're not telling them why they would, or they're not saying that frequently enough. And the frequency plus the messaging, it's like you can solve that gap pretty fast.
Yeah. Okay. You also do these virtual events about twice a month. Tell me about these. How do you structure them? What are the topics? How many people show up?
So with some of the folks that I initially sort of seeded this publication with, I was like, let's just start meeting and like trying some of the stuff out. Yeah, because I'm trying to get out of consulting, but I want to help people. And the newsletter can only do so much, right? It really helps for you to say to me, okay, well, I tried that thing you said, Lex, but here's why it didn't work for me. Yeah. So that's where consulting comes in, but I don't want to do consulting. So my solution to that was community events. And then what's cool about that is that I'm not a genius and other people have great ideas. And so we started formalizing those sort of over the summer. We do 2 events a month right now. Your next milestone is one of the formats. Mm. So folks come and they share their next goal. I want to hit 1,000 subscribers. I want to hit 10,000 subscribers. I want to start speaking. I want to add a different subscription tier, whatever that goal is. Mm. And then they tell us how they're going to do it. And other people share their experience with that, right? Like one of the things that comes up a lot is sponsorships and ads, right? Yeah. And somebody always has an interesting take on that. Obviously, newsletter growth always comes up. So people share cool ways that they're doing that. We met actually on Monday, and I wrote down, I think, 15 different growth strategies that people shared in that meeting on Monday, which was awesome.
What's been the most heated? Where's everyone really gotten into the topic? And like, it goes over by an hour or whatever. What's been the most, heated conversation?
I mean, I think like one of the most controversial growth things has been subsex cross recommendations, which Beehive has as well. Like the idea that when you sign up for a publication, you get like auto subscribe.
3 to 17 others. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. And I think Substack does that in kind of a shady way where it's like now it's like collapsed.
Yeah.
Where you just like auto subscribe to a bunch of publications you can't even see. In Beehive's case, you have to, I think, check them. So it's a little different, but that's a really controversial feature. And what's hard about it is it's a huge growth feature for me. Like it is really successful.
Yeah.
And, Casey Newton famously wrote this post about how he thought it was bad. We should stop using it. And so that's one that comes up quite a bit. I think ads also, like taking ads and running ads is also quite controversial. People don't want to give Facebook their money. I totally get that. This is another place where Beehive shines. And they're like, there's a lot of panic about working with brands. Like, okay, if I work with this sponsor, how do I push back when they say something about the content or whatever?
Yeah.
Those are the things that are tricky. But there's solutions to all that stuff. You know?
Yeah. You can read about them in Journalists Pay Themselves. Have you learned anything from these virtual events, these meetups? Anything that's really surprised you from the people?
I mean, I would say that it's incredibly encouraging how good journalists are at business. Like, I really want to share that hope with them because every time I talk with them about business, they say to me what you said to me earlier, which was like, we hate business. But then it's like, they're like secretly good at it. And I think it's fun. It's super fun to work with writers and people who care about what they're doing. like, they see business in such an interesting way, and they actually, like, they're just in a spot where they sort of have to be good at it, and they're leveling up so fast, and it's really, really fun to watch and hear about. Like, there's, you know, Alyssa Walker, who joins our events quite a bit. She's a journalist in LA who covers the LA Olympics, the 2028 Olympics.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Alyssa's newsletter is called Torch. It's amazing. She said there's no better growth lever than a good article. And that is so true.
Yeah. So this reminds me, something I used to always ask people in these interviews was like, and I stopped. I think it's been a couple months, is like, do you feel that you have a responsibility to your audience? Do you think about that? What is that? For you, I think it's quite obvious. It's to help journalists make money on the internet while doing like what they love to do. But I think more broadly is where I'm really interested in it, where like I believe, and I would imagine you believe too, that like people putting content out there, contributing to the corpus of the internet, like there is a responsibility just in like a, you know, a way we have a responsibility to be productive members of society, right? But I think it's like, and this goes back a bit to the marketing, the journalist versus like the more marketer side, is it's not necessarily incentivized. I don't know. Do you have thoughts on like how you can like incentivize this on a broader level, like how to encourage people to like have better ethics? Like, because I think this is one of the big differences between a journalist, somebody from a journalist background, somebody who's not, who's a creator, is like, there's no, you know, you haven't come through an organization where there is this really strict code that you're taught to adhere to. I don't know. It's kind of an unanswerable broad question, maybe.
But yeah.
Do you have any thoughts?
Yes. I have so many thoughts because I came from like a growth practice, right? Like I came up in the time of Andrew Tran and Brian Balfour and Chamath at Facebook, like all these growth guys. You know, and some of what we were doing at that time was not that ethical to grow tech companies. I think part of what it is working with journalists is actually helping them let go of some of those ethics, actually, because, you know, I think sometimes people go too far with that, especially indie creators.
Sometimes you need to bring a gun to a gunfight.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things I see people do on the flip side of this conversation is like, you know, there's a lot of conversations about ethical tech companies right now, right? Like who's ethical to work with, who's not. And it's like, do I think we should have those conversations as a society? Absolutely. Do I think you as an individual creator who has no audience or a very small audience is going to make a societal impact by not choosing this platform because you don't like the founder?
Yeah.
No, I think that's just going to damage your business.
Well, it's that meme, that panel from that comic about like, we should improve society and yet you participated in it, right? I think about that like literally every day. It's just that.
Yeah. I just think like if every decision is like, oh, I need to make the absolute most ethical decision possible, that becomes like a hindrance in your business.
Yeah.
So I think the thing to do is to be in conversation with other people and sort of check that stuff with them, right? If you're in creator communities, which I highly, highly recommend you be in,
absolutely,
or journalist communities or writer communities, just check that stuff. Hey, I'm thinking about turning on this cross recommendations. Pros and cons, everybody? Like what's you know, because sometimes there is like a legitimate business downside even to the bad actor stuff. And then you're like, oh, okay, turns out that was bad anyway. Yeah. Great.
Easy
I won't
decision
do it.
To make.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So something I read, speaking of going back to paid subscription businesses, something I read in your newsletter is that $9 per month is the ideal base price for a subscription offering, and that it's fairly obvious to you that that is the ideal price.
According to me, yes.
Yeah. How
According
did you get
to
there?
Me, it's $9. Okay, so I analyzed 14 different worker-owned outlets, 404 Media, Hellgate, Rascal,
Defector.
Range, Defector, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I looked at their pricing. The majority of the starting tier was between $5 and $10.
Yeah.
I agree with Matt Brown, who writes Extra Points, a Beehive sports publication, that it's not worth doing anything closer to the $5 tier. Like, getting someone to pay you at all is hard. So I think there's this sentiment of like, oh, people don't want to pay. They want to pay $1, $3, right? Patreon and Substack popularized the $5 tier. But I'm with Matt that if someone's paying $5, they can pay $7. And actually, if they can pay $7, they can pay $9. And if you're going to put in the labor, keep it single digit.
Yeah.
But if you're going to put in the labor, you might as well get the $9, right? Like these are people that have disposable income. No one's like giving you their lunch money, right? So The $5 subscriber and the $9 subscriber are the same person. The $9 subscriber and the $99 subscriber are different people.
Yeah.
Right? Or people who are on a different path with your publication.
That's like your niche business product.
Yes. Or you're like absolute biggest fan, or your founding fan, right? Mm-hmm. Or your corporate fan. Yeah. So they're different people. You're catering to them in different ways. But, you know, you're not going to lose a lot of people going from 5 to 9. So I priced mine at 9 as well. Yeah. And I'm a big fan of that. And it's interesting. I actually would really love to hear from 404 because they're at 10. Why they went to 10 instead of 9. And it would be really interesting to know if that actually is the limit there. Is it 9 to 10? Like, it's hard to know.
So that's a good transition to subscription fatigue, which I should say personally, like, I'm currently not paying for 404. I read a lot of their work. I've been thinking about paying, but I am currently paying for Hellgate, and I'm paying for some others. And then, you know, there's plenty of publications I read and I don't pay for. And in my mind, it's like, I only ever want to be spending, I don't know, not $100 per month on these subscriptions, but like not a manageable amount because I'm reading so much. Like, I'm not going to read every article from the thing I'm subscribing to. So it needs to make sense, right? So like, that's my personal subscription fatigue experience. And, you know, I'll like unsubscribe to one to subscribe to another. 3 months later, I'll do that again with another. Yeah. What do you think about subscription fatigue?
Yeah. Well, because subscription fatigue goes beyond just media subscriptions, right? And beyond newsletter subscriptions.
Well, like Hulu, Netflix,
Spotify. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I heard the auto manufacturers are about to make our cars
subscriptions. Every piece of software. Well, it's Salesforce that we have to blame for all this, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if you run your own business, then you're paying, QuickBooks and Notion and whatever else, Google. Mm-hmm. So I understand that like subscription fatigue is a thing. But I think as a creator, you have to ignore that because one, people who want your work to exist understand that you need to get paid. And two, it's way more work for you to chase down one-time contributions than for you to get someone into a recurring subscription. Mm-hmm. And so you can play with things like discounts. You can play with things like annual, right? Which I think for some people comes across as like less of a annoying thing. It's like, okay, I'm just going to pay $100 a year. That feels less bad than taking on this monthly expense.
I rarely do that personally.
You what?
I rarely do that. I'm almost always a monthly guy.
Yeah. But I think some people are different, right? And this is the thing. Your audience is not a monolith. And so you have to play with these things and sort of see. I also think I like Matt Kisser's point from What the Fuck Just Happened Today about some people just are never going to be monthly people. Give them a one-time option.
Yeah.
That's fine. But I wouldn't shy away from monthly contributions because you personally hate subscriptions. Like, this is something I hear all the time from people. They're like, well, I hate getting newsletters, so I don't want to have a newsletter. It's like, if you don't want to have a newsletter, fine, but like,
but you're not your audience.
You're not your audience. Like, you know, I hate getting direct mail, but guess what? It's really effective, and that's why we get so much of it.
Yeah. You said on an issue of Revenue Rule Breaker, your pop-up newsletter, that you kind of have framed your subscription offering as a subscription to Lex and not to any one project, which I think is really a very creator way of looking at it, right? Where it's like, because that's another thing sometimes when I've asked people, well, what is a creator? And they've said, well, it's like a personality-driven content entrepreneur. Tell me more about that. Like, did you used to frame it more on a per-project base and now it's about supporting Lex?
Yeah, it's funny because when I started my business in 2019, it was called Lex Roman Inc. Like my corporation name was Lex Roman Inc. because I sort of knew that I was the brand at that point. And I was, even though I started as a consultancy, I was doing a ton of writing and speaking and teaching and had a personal brand around growth design that was beyond my client work. And somewhere along the way in the small business realm, I started these like mini brands, right? So a bunch of the things you've heard in this show. Growth trackers, low energy leads, revenue pool picker, journalist. I started these like brands, these like spinoff brands. And then I would like latch into one and then I would decide I didn't want to do that project anymore. Mm-hmm. Low energy leads was my main newsletter for like a year and a couple months. And then I was like, I actually don't want to write this newsletter anymore. So I need to start lifting up above these brands and recognize that some of these people will come with me, right? Yeah. Like for some people, this is where we leave each other, but for others, they're going to come along. You know, before all this, I had another newsletter, my Substack, LA Pays Attention, actually one of the first growth trackers was a reader of that newsletter. That was a political newsletter about LA. So you never know who is going to come through some of these different iterations. And if you're like me and you can't pick a lane, like you can sort of rebrand as yourself, even if you're not like, I'm not like a lifestyle influencer, right? Yeah. I'm more of a B2B creator. I focus on monetization and marketing.
But it's still like whichever, I'm sure even from the LA newsletter up until now, it's still like all about like your particular philosophies and like your like political outlook, look, you know, bleeding through, like obviously a clear connection there. If you're like doing kind of LA journalism to now you're like doing content for journalists, like, it's all ideologically going to be of a thread.
Yeah. Well, and now that I'm doing Journalists Pay Themselves, a lot of the folks who were on LA Pays Attention were journalists. And they're coming back up and they're like, I used to read that and now I'm over here. And so I used to sort of be like, okay, bye forever. I'm going to go do something else. But now I'm like, no, I think some of these people might want to come. And the ones who don't, they can just get off the train and that's totally fine.
Yeah. What is your relationship like to social media? Because you don't have huge followings. I think LinkedIn might be your biggest. We've covered a bunch already how, you know, you're not a big audience type of person. But yeah, what's your relationship with social media?
I have a minuscule social media following. Like, people act like my level of social media following like doesn't even exist, right? Like creators will be like, well, these small creators at 10,000 followers.
You've got like 635 on Twitter or whatever.
Yeah, it's like nothing. Yeah, absolutely nothing. Yeah, I mean, social media is interesting because I have really good conversion off of LinkedIn, like in terms of
people coming on. Well, you are a B2B person.
I'm a B2B person. And so I've had, you know, clients for years have come through LinkedIn. I've stayed in touch with people on LinkedIn. That's how people hop from all my different projects. I've gotten people into my paid subscription, into growth trackers from LinkedIn. I get a lot of DMs there and speaking opportunities there. It's always been a big business driver for me. Twitter, actually, when I started Journalists Pay Themselves, I had deleted my Twitter years ago. So I started over this year exclusively because I wanted to reach journalists and that's where I knew that they were. So I started Journalists Pay Themselves. I had like 50 followers on Twitter, right? Like, but because I think this message was not being said very often, it stood out. So I started like replying to journalists on Twitter and that's how Nick got in touch with me at Hellgate. Like that was when I had very few followers, like almost non-existent account, right?
Yeah.
Like almost suppression by a Twitter level of account. Like this person might be a bot level.
Yeah.
But it was, I think, enough of a resonant message that people were like, okay, let me see who this person is, which is the thing. If you're going to be a small audience person, your message has to be really good. You can't just be like sort of parroting this like generic thing. You need to have a take.
When you have to show like that you're authentically a person. Like I feel like I see a lot of people who are good at growing an audience, but it's like such like clear, and maybe it's just because I have worked in this and like ghostwritten these for other people, but it's such clear like growth hacking stuff. Like you're not trying to engage with anybody. You're just trying to get engagement in a one-way transaction.
Yes. Well, and if you can't back that up, like through your products, through your services, then that's going to dead end for you and you're going to stay on a content treadmill forever, right? Which goes back to the listening to the audience thing, right? Yeah. I think people still think about content as a funnel. I think we overweight social media in our marketing efforts and we underweight this like word of mouth engine, which is honestly way more fun to crack, way more efficient for you as a creator and way more rewarding for your audience. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I try to lean away from social. I do use it, but I don't like.
Just to doom scroll.
I don't doom scroll and I just like I've stopped sweating. Like I cannot nail short form video. Like I cannot, right? Like YouTube is not my bag as much as I would like it to be. It's just like not. Newsletters are something I'm good at, so I'm just trying to lean into what I'm good at. Community building is something I'm good at, so I'm just leveraging the things that that work for me, you know?
In the same way I asked, what is a creator? What is a newsletter?
Okay, I think of a newsletter as a piece of content that stands alone that isn't trying to sell you something necessarily. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
It can sell you something, but it's not always trying to sell you something. So like an email list is like a business would have an email list and that can be just for selling you stuff. Like the hotel that you recently went to, they have an email list. It's probably not a newsletter. They're just selling you hotel stuff.
Yeah. This is good. So the way I hadn't thought about this in a while and I wrote it down knowing I'd ask you this question. What I wrote was it's a non-transactional themed email sent to a mailing list.
Love it. Yeah. It's a really thin distinction, though, right? And people struggle with it. And the funny thing, I was telling my email friend, Tarzan K, who I also recommend folks. Do you know Tarzan, Francis?
I don't think I do.
Oh, my God. Tarzan is an email marketer who made a transition into the newsletter space. I was telling Tarzan, I think I actually pivoted too hard into the newsletter space. And I had to reestablish an email list recently. Because I have so many projects, I do need to sell people more frequently. And so I needed an email list where I could be more salesy.
Yeah. Well, so I think Substack comes onto the scene and creates this like wave of like individual creator columnists. And like that's a type of newsletter. But then there's the more publication type of newsletters, right? Like all the independent organizations we've been talking about, 404, Hellgate, et cetera. And then there's things that are kind of in between. But I wonder, like, because the individual creator columnist, I think this is why, this is what Substack is great for. It's like, you don't know really what you want to do. You're not thinking about any of this except, hey, I want to write. It's kind of somehow, I don't really know what I want to write about. So you can just go in and like super easy to just start writing and like, you know, be on those lists of recommendations and get some subscribers. But like, is that a lasting thing in the same way that like was Medium a lasting thing, right? I don't know. And that's where like a Beehive, a Ghost, et cetera, these other things that are more about like building a business and aren't social networks, like that probably has more longevity. And I like a bunch of these, you know, personal essay columnists. I'm writing about one this week for the newsletter, Alex Dobrenko. But with him too, he writes the newsletter. Both are true. Like one thing I noticed going like went through all his archive, et cetera, and like kind of watching this person who was like a stand-up comedian, wannabe, who didn't really want to do the open mic stuff. He's like, I'm going to try to do stand-up on Substack, right? And he starts doing that. But then you see him like kind of professionalizing and trying to make a business out of it. He like plays this character called Brad C. Unversion, like Brad Conversion, where it's like him sublimating his desire to not do marketing, right? And like just putting it in this character that then allows him to think about it and talk about it. Anyways, I think like, because it's a lot of work to like write good personal essays, at least on the internet. And like it takes hours, and especially if you're committing to the weekly thing. And I think there's like, I don't know, maybe like over the next five years, there's more and more like kind of just bloggy ones that people will write like once every couple months. You know, you write an essay. But then there's also more like really dialed in businesses around content. And I think that's like a difference too, that I see between Beehive and Substack. Like a Substack, you know, that has become like Kleenex for tissue, right? But like what a Substack is like a single columnist who, maybe it's not even a personal essay style, but like they're not, again, going back to what you said at the beginning, it's not really about making money, monetizing. It's about like building an audience that maybe you do with other things. I don't know.
Yeah.
On my soapbox
You've hit on what my main beef with Substack, right? And I'm trying to be more even keeled about it because I have some Substackers in my DMs who I love dearly.
Yeah.
Who
are I subscribe to a bunch of Substacks. I like them.
No, obviously. I do too. But I think I've been really raging against Substack because I've started to like dig back into what's going on there. And I'm like, I actually think they're really screwing over these writers, right? They're sort of making this sales pitch that you can have growth on autopilot. That's the line that they reuse over and over again in their documentation. We're doing growth on autopilot for you. And what they're doing is audience on autopilot.
Ah, yes.
Right? They're not doing monetization really at all, not even in the manual way. So they don't even do manual monetization. They certainly do not do automated monetization. And so like what you're saying with Alex is a perfect example. Substackers that I'm coming across, like Eric Newcomer, who has, I think, 100,000 subscribers on Substack.
$2 million in revenue, right?
$2 million in revenue. Big asterisk, paid subscribers flat for 2 years, right? That revenue growth is coming from events and other sponsorships and other revenue streams. Substack is not making that happen, right? So,
And crucially, they're not making more money on that, which is their business model.
Which makes absolutely no sense, right? So it's like they're not enabling sponsorships really at all, which, you know, is a product choice, which is you can sort of make an argument for. But the fact that they're not helping people sell subscriptions, their only lever there is this thing called Boost, which is different than Beehive Boost, right? And it's like a series of discounts that they're offering. Yeah. It's just really lame. Like, I don't know if like no one at Substack knows how to monetize subscriptions. Maybe they need to hire more creators in house. but they're just not even enabling that. So my rec to Substackers for sure is to think about moving away from Substack once you have like a good audience base. You know, to me, the minimum there is like 1,000. Once you have some folks on your list, like I would think about getting out of there. If you feel like you can't leave, I would back it up with a list tool that will actually let you automate and segment your audience so you can sell to them.
That's a good point. Maybe just one more question. So you've been doing this for not even a year. Based on your track record, are you still going to be doing it in 2 years? Or what
that is such a great question. That remains to be seen.
Yeah.
I think it depends a bit on sort of like the opportunities that come my way in this space and whether or not I can make a living doing like trainings and speaking and the subscription. Yeah. Like, you know, I pivot out of necessity, right? Either because it gets to be too operationally challenging for me or there's not enough interest in the space. But I guess like on some level, I would like to solve some of this quickly for journalists. Like I would like for more journalists to feel confident that they can launch their own newsletter, launch their own publication.
Oh, like ideally, this is a corpus that you can complete.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I don't know how long I'll be doing it, but I'm not like trying to prolong it necessarily. Yeah. If we can solve it faster, I think we should. Because I can always find another thing to do. So, yeah.
You always go back to TV production.
Yeah, no kidding. Absolutely not. I would never. But yeah, exactly. That kind of thing.
Cool. Well, I guess we'll stop it there. Where should people go to find you? Journalists pay themselves?
Yeah, journalists pay themselves. And then I have all of these random things that we've talked about at LexRoman.com.
LexRoman.com. Well, Lex, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. And everyone else, I'll see you next week. This has been Creator Spotlight. Bye-bye.